And now for some people's history. Here are some anniversaries to note this coming week. On July 25th, 1898, the United States invaded Puerto Rico. Here's one perspective on that from the Progressive Magazine, July 20th, 1998, by Martin Espada. On July 25th, 1898, U.S. troops landed in Puerto Rico and seized the island as a prize of the Spanish-American War. The colonial relationship between the U.S. and Puerto Rico has not fundamentally changed since that time. The invasion was directed by General Nelson Miles, who once hunted down Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse. He promised Puerto Ricans the blessings of an enlightened civilization. That civilization imposed a series of North American governors, prohibited Puerto Rico from electing its own governor until after World War II, greedily exploited the labor and natural resources of the island, established a menacing strategic military presence, and forced English on the public schools and the court systems, and repressed the independence movement. Since the 1920s, the federal law of seditious conspiracy has been used almost exclusively against Puerto Ricans, according to historian Ronald Fernandez. In 1936, the leaders of the militantly pro-independence Nationalist Party were imprisoned after two sedition trials. Colonialism is inherently anti-democratic. In Puerto Rico, the population cannot vote for the President of the United States, but can be drafted to fight and die in the wars of the United States. The island is represented in Congress only by a non-voting resident commissioner, yet Congress controls virtually all significant aspects of Puerto Rican political life. Puerto Rico is the oldest colony in the world, 4 centuries under Spain and 1 century under the United States. July 28, 1915, we have a similar anniversary. The U.S. invaded Haiti under American President Woodrow Wilson. The specific order from the Navy to the invasion commander, Admiral Bundy, was to, quote, protect American and foreign interests. On July 29, 1970, California's largest grape grower signed the United Farm Workers contract after years of struggle and grape boycotts. In 1965, September, the fledgling Farm Workers Association voted to join a strike that had been initiated by Filipino farm workers in Delano's grape fields. Within months, Cesar Chavez and his union became nationally known. Chavez's drawing on the imagery of the civil rights movement, his insistence on nonviolence, his reliance on volunteers from urban universities and religious organizations, his alliance with organized labor, and his use of mass mobilizing techniques, such as a famous march on Sacramento in 1966, brought the grape strike and consumer boycott into the national consciousness. The boycott in particular was responsible for pressuring the growers to recognize the United Farm Workers. The first contracts were signed in 1966, but were followed by more years of strife. In 1968, Chavez went on a fast for 25 days to protest the increasing advocacy of violence from within the union. Victory came finally on July 29, 1970, when 26 Delano growers formally signed contracts recognizing the United Farm Workers and bringing peace to the vineyards. Last year during this week, July 23rd through 25th, 2004, the Boston Social Forum was held. Over 50 labor, environmental, peace, human rights, civil rights, neighborhood, and women's groups came together to organize the Boston Social Forum, which brought thousands of activists from throughout New England and around the world together at the University of Massachusetts in Boston to share ideas and experiences, build new networks and alliances, and to articulate an alternative vision for our collective future. Modeled on the World Social Forum, which has brought tens of thousands of activists from social movements around the world together in Porto Alegre, Brazil, and Mumbai, India, together to share their strategies, analysis, and proposals. The Boston Social Forum was the first major social forum in North America. At the moment, a Maine social forum is being planned as well. And now for Tom Jackson interviewing Arnie Alpert on the Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA.
For Making Waves, I'm Tom Jackson. In the upcoming week, Congress will be voting on the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. And this free trade agreement has a very direct effect on states. As with most international free trade agreements, there is a chapter in it on government procurement or purchasing of goods and services. And in that chapter, each state is asked if they want to bind their procurement rules to CAFTA. Initially, former Governor Benson said yes. But now it seems that current New Hampshire Governor Lynch is leaning in the other direction. And I had heard that he was against it. However, when I contacted his office to try to get an interview, which was ultimately declined, they indicated that actually he just has some questions about CAFTA and is not necessarily completely against it. I then took my questions to the person in New Hampshire who knows more than anyone else I can think of about free trade agreements, and that's Arnie Alpert, the director of New Hampshire's chapter of the American Friends Service Committee.
I think that obviously Governor Lynch and his staff need to speak for him. My impression is that they don't consider the CAFTA to be a New Hampshire issue other than the fact that Lynch's predecessor, Craig Benson, signed New Hampshire up, in effect, as a participant in the government procurement chapter of CAFTA. And Lynch studied the issue and said, no, we're not interested in binding our own state's procurement or purchasing policies to these trade rules. Take New Hampshire off the list. So that's the, and I think that's the extent of what they wanted to do with regard to CAFTA.
But is CAFTA a New Hampshire issue or an issue for individual states in general? I mean, it seems to me that it's going to affect people's jobs in a number of states.
Now, obviously, CAFTA is a New Hampshire issue. One thing is that the last I heard, the U.S. Trade Representative had actually not complied with the governor's request, and that CAFTA, which is going forward for a vote in Congress probably in about 2 weeks, still has New Hampshire listed on, you know, Annex 9 in the list of states that say that they are going to comply with CAFTA's procurement rules. So that's one part. An element of this which escapes most of the mainstream media discussion about trade agreements, whether it's CAFTA or NAFTA or WTO rules or anything, is that this is not just about reducing tariffs for trade in agricultural and manufactured commodities. What these trade agreements represent is a radical rewriting of all of the rules of global or international commerce. And because so much of our commerce is now international, what it really means is it's a rewriting of the rules of how our economy functions. And the way they're written is a way in which the authority of local government and state government is stripped away and subsumed under these obscure trade rules.
Let's step back just for a second. And for people who don't necessarily know what CAFTA is, or maybe there's, I'm sure there's some confusion sometimes with CAFTA and NAFTA and everything else out there. Give us a basic description of what CAFTA is all about.
Okay. CAFTA is a trade agreement between the United States, the Dominican Republic, and the five countries of Central America. That's Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica. What it's intended to do, say its backers, is to increase trade or increase commercial activity between these seven countries, which would, they say, lead to a promotion of economic growth, and thereby a rising tide would raise all boats. Critics of CAFTA maintain that it will make it more likely that manufacturing jobs and even service sector jobs will leave the United States and go to these countries where wages are very low and unions tend to be weak or non-existent, that it will enable the markets of the Central American countries to be flooded with subsidized agro-industrial products from the United States, which will drive small farmers out of business. Likewise, small farmers in the United States will face increasing competition, possibly from products, agricultural products grown in Central America and the Dominican Republic, such as sugar. The Central American countries will be forced to honor basically U.S. standards on trademarks and copyrights, which will make it harder for them to license generic medicines or to protect traditional seeds from genetically modified seeds produced by companies like Monsanto. We could go on and on. Under the procurement rules, communities may be forced to privatize their water or other basic services, and under the services rules of CAFTA, regulations and policies set by governments at all levels could be challenged as being unfairly burdensome to the companies that are engaging in international commerce. And one more thing, under CAFTA's investment rules, which are modeled on those of NAFTA, any government policy which harms or inhibits or inheres the profitability of a foreign investor from any of the CAFTA countries can be challenged as an unfair trade practice, and that company or that investor could be entitled to win direct monetary compensation. This is a lot of stuff. And that's part of the problem with this, is that CAFTA itself is some 3,500 pages long. It's densely worded tariff schedules. It's legalese that is only decipherable to trade lawyers. It is unlikely that very many members of Congress have spent much time actually reading and trying to understand the text of this agreement. Yet its implications are profound, and there is a lot at stake.
And some of the basic tenets of the whole thing that you just mentioned sound awfully familiar. You know, outside of Central America, for example, many of those same things are being imposed on Iraq today.
It's a model of what the Bush administration or some might call free trade, but really it's a restructuring of commercial activities to benefit investors and corporations that are engaged in international commerce. And doing that by taking away the ability of governments to determine what is in the best interest of the people that they're representing. It's also very similar to NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico, which went into effect in 1994, and we could talk more about the impact of that. It's very similar and has a lot in common with the rules of the World Trade Organization. It is for countries that are poor, like the countries of Central America, the same sets of principles are also enforced by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, trying to drive these countries in the same direction of a very narrow range of policy options that are available to them to determine what they can do in the best interest of their citizens.
Have these types of agreements, so-called free trade agreements, taken jobs away from the people of New Hampshire?
We have lost a lot of manufacturing sector jobs and some service sector jobs in New Hampshire because companies find it beneficial to site their manufacturing or their operations in countries where wages are very low, where benefits are very low, where environmental restrictions are weak, where taxes are low, where they may get more government subsidies. And that might be China, it might be Mexico, it might be Central America. What these trade agreements do, the trade agreements don't create the conditions by which that happens, but they protect the conditions and they make those conditions pretty much permanent. So what that does is it builds in, it takes away the ability of the state of New Hampshire or our communities or of the United States government to try to bring those jobs back to the United States. But if you look all over the state, you can find companies that have gone out of business or are losing jobs, whether we're talking GE and Somersworth, whether we're talking Anna Lee Dolls, whether we're talking, I don't have the list in my head right now, but it's a long list of New Hampshire companies. We've lost a huge number of manufacturing jobs in recent years. one of the things that's important, I've also had the opportunity to spend time in Guatemala and Honduras, Costa Rica and Nicaragua in recent years, and I do have to say that people there are mostly poor, they're unemployed or underemployed. They actually would welcome good jobs coming into their countries. The problem with this agreement is it's not like a matter of we lose but they gain, and maybe in the end we end up better off overall. We actually end up with, it's sort of a lose-lose situation from the perspective of working people and small farmers and folks who care about the environment or consumer protection rules. People in Nicaragua, people in El Salvador say, yes, they want jobs, but they want jobs with dignity. They want jobs with rights. They want to be able to speak up about problems in their workplace without fear that they're going to get fired or kidnapped. They want the right to be able to form unions, just like people in our communities want that right for ourselves. Those rights are not enhanced by this agreement. In fact, they're undermined by these agreements by just making it easier for the companies to pick up at a moment's notice, close the factory, and move somewhere else where people are either more desperate for jobs or where they just simply think that the government is going to look out for their interests more closely.
And if I'm not mistaken, there are cases where people in sweatshops in Central America and elsewhere have tried to organize and the companies have just shut the places down. Is that right?
Well, we've certainly seen that here. We know that if workers try to organize now in a manufacturing plant, they're really going to expect the management to say, if you try to form a union here, we're going to close shop and move to Mexico or move to China or move to El Salvador. Well, the same thing is happening now in Mexico. Since NAFTA went into effect, companies are threatening, if you don't calm down, we're going to move to Honduras or Nicaragua or somewhere else in Mexico, or move to China, which is actually where most of them are going. Same thing is happening. What it does is it enables the employers to play off the workers against each other so that people, you know, the way the workers end up competing with each other is by agreeing to work for less and less money. This is what we call the recipe for the race to the bottom. CAFTA continues the race to the bottom for workers, for farmers, and for communities. And that's part of what's the problem with this whole so-called free trade model.
Well, as the director of New Hampshire's American Friends Service Committee, is there a sort of program that's that you're following that's designed to educate people about CAFTA?
Well, we work with groups like the New Hampshire Fair Trade Campaign, with the New Hampshire AFL-CIO. I had an email from somebody from one of the environmental groups the other day to try to make sure that people have information about this so that they can contact their members of Congress. In our case, it's Charlie Bass and Jeb Bradley. We're also working right now to help people in some other states mobilize folks to contact members of Congress who are believed to be undecided about these agreements. It's going down to the wire in Congress right now. Some of the other trade agreements like NAFTA have been passed by very small margins. The bill that gave President Bush what they call fast-track negotiating authority was passed by one vote in what many felt was a very manipulative and unfair process in the House of Representatives. That's kind of the thing we're expecting to happen right now.
So you'd recommend that concerned citizens who want to try to do something about this should call their congresspeople before the last week in July? Is that a good idea?
We're expecting right now the vote may come up during the last week of July, so we think that people from New Hampshire should contact Congressman Jeb Bradley, who represents the Portsmouth area. People in the western and northern parts of the state should contact Congressman Charlie Bass. The congressman in southern Maine, is it Congressman Allen? And I believe he has come out strongly against CAFTA, in which case he should be commended for that.
Arnie Alpert, director of New Hampshire AFSC, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Levántese, compañero, que solo fue una batalla. La guerra la ganaremos, haciendo una gran muralla. ganaremos haciendo una gran muralla. La guerra la ganaremos cuando aprendamos a ver que si la clase está unida, nadie la puede vencer. Que si la clase está unida, nadie la puede vencer. Nunca fue herido de muerte quien tenía la razón. Él está donde está pueblo, no donde el gran señor. Él está donde está pueblo, no donde el gran señor. Pedro, Juanita, Manuela, vamos a curar la herida con la unidad de los pobres, los de la clase ofendida, con la unidad de los pobres, los de la clase ofendida. Levántese, compañero, si hoy día somos cien, mañana serán millones los que estaremos de pie. Mañana serán millones los que estaremos de pie. Levántese, compañero, que solo fue una batalla. La guerra la ganaremos haciendo una gran muralla. La guerra la ganaremos haciendo una gran muralla.
That was Charlie King and Karen Branda with Levantes, Compañero, the translation of which is, Rise up, my companion. This was just one battle, but we will win the great war by uniting the poor and oppressed. The person with the truth is never mortally wounded. He is alongside the people as we carry on his work. There may only be 100 of us today, but tomorrow millions of us will be on our feet. So rise up. Victory will be ours. We now go to Jeff White for Down to Earth. In this episode, he is going to be talking with organic farmer from New Hampshire, Charlie Reed.
Greetings and welcome to Down to Earth. We are here speaking with Charlie Reed, who happens to be an organic farmer and also teaches at UNH. I'm going to have a conversation with Charlie about some of the things that he does and has experienced over the years doing organic farming in New Hampshire, and also talk a little bit about NOFA, which is the Northeast Organic Farming Association. We're sitting outside near a pond that he created out of some springs, and so if you hear things in the background like animals and dogs and so forth, that's because we're outside enjoying the nice weather. Okay, Charlie, welcome to Down to Earth.
Thank you. Well, my relationship with organic gardening and farming started back in 1968. spending the winter in California and learned about organic food and organic gardening from a woman who had cured herself of cancer. And I worked with her in her gardens, and I was a teenager at the time, and really felt that that was a good thing to be doing, growing food without chemicals and living off that food. Nothing more important than the body that you've been given and taking care of it and watching what you put into it. Your body is like an engine. If you change the oil all the time and you keep it tuned up, then you probably might last a while. We have cancer problems, obesity, diabetes. There's so many problems out there now with the health of the people on this earth that we've got to realize that to help yourself out a little bit is to watch what you eat. You are what you eat, and it's true. So wherever I've lived from the time I was a teenager on, I've always managed to be able to have a garden in the backyard. Started working on commercial farms as a teenager in my early 20s and ended up caretaking this old Kelsey homestead here in Nottingham, New Hampshire. And the owners, when they got back from California that following year, sold me this piece across the street. It's completely surrounded by stone walls. It's an old hayfield, and I've reclaimed it and cut down trees and built my own house here. And I built this little pond here. We have trout in it. Nice place to relax. And we have blueberry bushes and apple trees and small crops, lettuce. We have greenhouses here to get an extended season, start a little earlier. And I have a big field up the street, so that's where the majority of the food is that I grow. And mostly for farmers markets, health food stores, local grocery stores. President Leitzel, about 10 years ago, wanted to have what I've been doing here as an accredited course at the university. So we set up a class called Plant Biology 600, which is the field experience part of UNH, and students can come here and work 80 hours and get a full credit. And then I took it a step further and asked the university to put aside some land that we could have an organic garden on. I put together an organic garden club, and right now the fields out in front of UNH Dairy Barns is all under organic certification with a 2-acre garden on it being maintained by students and food being sold back into the university system to be fed to other students. And now the university has taken it a step further, and with Stonyfield Yogurt, they've gotten a $200,000 grant from them, and the university's chipping in another $400,000, and they're putting together an organic dairy and transitioning the existing herd over into organic so that within a year, UNH will be producing organic milk for Stonyfield Yogurt. So the university's listening, and they're moving in that direction. As well should a lot of people, because organic food is the wave of the future. You go to grocery stores in California, and complete aisle after aisle after aisle is full of organic food. What's happening now is that the stores are realizing that the public is coming in looking for organic food, and they've got to find it for them. So that's why I spend as much time as I possibly can talking to farmers, especially small farmers and farmers just starting out, and convincing them that organic is the way to go. And we see it more and more in the farmers markets where the people come in and they go right to the organic farmers and clean them out. They buy all their food. So I think it's encouraging, and it's finally people are listening to us.
Can you just let people know where they might find organic food in the area?
All of your health food stores, you know, definitely promote organic food. Your farmers markets that are located just about everywhere now. I mean, years ago, when I started in the farmers markets, there were 8 throughout the state of New Hampshire. Now there's over 50. So that's a good place to get fresh food. The grocery stores, like I said, are doing a pretty good job of advertising organic food. And it basically gets down to, if you want organic food and you go to a store that's near your neighborhood or home where you shop regularly, just go to the owner of the store. Go to the produce manager and say, look, if you get organic food in here, I'll come in and buy it. And that's what they'll do. They'll turn around and say, hey, we're getting people requesting this type of food, so we better go out and try to find it. If they want it, they can find it. It's out there. And the more people that start growing it, the better it is. The more it'll make available for everybody.
Can you speak a little bit about the work that you've done with NOFA, which is the Northeast Organic Farming Association?
Yes, NOFA was started back in the early 70s by a man named Samuel Kamen, who went on to be the founder of Stonyfield Yogurt. So Samuel has a great history of promoting and really hands-on, getting in, getting dirty, and getting food growing, and put together this wonderful organization called the Northeast Organic Farming Organization, which now encompasses 7 states, thousands of members. It also has a sister organization up in Maine called MOFCA, the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, which is another huge farming organization. I think MOFCA and NOFA. MOFCA is so big that it has, I think, the same amount of membership as NOFA does in 7 states, MOFCA has in 1 state. But then again, Maine is huge. So they do, NOFA does a summer conference in August out in Western Mass, and really does a good job of promoting and educating the public about, you know, how to grow food, and they put on workshops and classes.
Can you tell people when exactly and where specifically that might be this year?
In Hampshire College, out in Amherst, Mass, every August, right around the 10th or 11th, they put on a 3-day weekend summer conference. They have hundreds of workshops. You can go there and camp out with your tent, and they have it's almost like a little circus, like a little fair. Mm-hmm. And very, very educational. And people come, you can meet people from all over the New England area. And it's a good break in the summer. It gives you a chance to get away from gardening or whatever else you might be doing. But it's very educational. And I've been many times. I was the Interstate Council Representative for NOFA for about 5 years, which means you went to these meetings 4 times a year where representatives from all the NOFA states would come and we would talk about issues and learn from each other what other states are doing. If something worked successfully for them, they would bring it to these meetings and share it so that we could bring those ideas back to the different states and learn from that. So it's just mostly just communication amongst like-minded people is what these organizations do. The sharing of information and knowledge and experiences. Farmers that are just starting out and backyard gardeners, a lot of people are retiring. They're still young. They have 2 or 3 acres. They've got a big place in the backyard, or they could have a garden. They're realizing, geez, you know what I could do? I could have a garden. I could grow food. I could get in the farmers markets, or I could supply a store down the street. And, how am I going to do that? Well, if you get involved with things like NOFA and their workshops in MOFCA, they do their big the Common Ground Fair up in MOFCA and Unity in September, the third weekend of September.
Common Ground Fair.
That's a huge organic fair with, again, hundreds and hundreds of workshops and hands-on teaching. The good thing about what they got going on there is they have gardens right there. You can walk through the gardens. They'll show you the name of plants. There's people who sell seeds for your garden, and you can walk right out in the field and see, there's your copra onion. These are copra onions in the seed pack, and there's a copra onion grown. That's what you will get from the seed. So now you can see exactly what you're getting in the seed pack and what your end product is going to be. Flowers the same way. They work very closely with Johnny's and Petco, places like that. So that's what I find very rewarding about these organic organizations and the things that they put on.
Could you speak a little bit about the difficulty of getting certified organic? Can you talk a little bit about some of the issues surrounding that? Mm-hmm. I guess specifically to New Hampshire, but maybe even in general sense.
Well, in years ago, each state had their own certifying agents. MOFCA in Maine, NOFA Vermont, NOFA Mass. But then October of 2002, the USDA in Washington took over the word organic, and all certifying agents come under that one umbrella of being, quote, certified organic for your food. And they put together a rule that they worked on for about 10 years. The rule was pretty intense. I would say that probably 80% of it I agree with, and another 20% I find a lot of it, you know, unnecessary and to be a burden to organic farmers, like turning your compost 5 times a year and keeping track of when you turned it, what the temperature was when you turned it, things like that. You know, farmers know how to farm. They know how to put their compost piles, bookkeeping, record keeping. It's just a never-ending body of work that you have to do other than organic farming. I mean, I'm wondering what organic farming is coming to if you have to run in the house when you get out of the field from working all day, and you have to sit down at a computer or a log of paperwork and keep a journal and write everything you did and when you weeded the potatoes and when you didn't. And it's getting to be a little confusing. And a lot of the older certified organic people that have a clientele that knows who they are, knows how they farm and trust them, they're moving into this certified naturally grown definition. That's an organization that is cropping up. And you basically certify yourself. If you know that you're doing things without chemicals and without artificial and synthetic fertilizers, you can be part of this movement, and it advertises your food as certified naturally grown. So whichever way you look at it, it's not the same anymore. And it's all regimented now, and you have to go by these rules, and you got to obey them. And if you don't obey them, you're being held in what's called non-compliance.
I find it kind of ironic being so regulated, but then they're telling companies, for instance, big industry, that they can regulate themselves. Do you think that there could be some other reason besides trying to standardize it so it makes it better for everybody? It sounds a little bit like they're, you know, some people are getting, maybe getting frustrated with the system, so may not do organic agriculture.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard a lot of people have gone and just taken one look at the application scares them away. They won't even deal with it. They're like, I don't want to do that. I just want to farm. I just want to grow food. You know, the way we feel in the organic community, I know I feel this way, and I know a lot of other organic people feel the same way, is that we shouldn't be the ones that are regulated. The people that are dumping poisons all over their food and chemicals all over their food are the ones that should be regulated. You know, when you throw in powders and dust on food and then bringing the food in your house and eating it, and those powders and dust cause health problems, you know, we're not the ones that feel, we're not dumping those things on our food. You know, we feel things should be reversed. But it seems to me that the government, because organic food probably sells for a little more, I don't know, I sell my food for the same money as the conventional farmers do in the farmers market, because we're selling a food that's a premium type food that might be worth a little bit more money, which they do charge more money for it, that we need to show on paper, a paper trail of the seeds that we use and where we got them, and then another paper trail on the garden space that we've got and where we planted these things. And then in the end, truly have to, when I load my truck on a Friday night to go to the farmer's market on Saturday morning in Portsmouth, I have to stand by that truck with a sheet of paper, and I have to write on that sheet of paper everything that's in that truck that's going in there. How much lettuce, how much Swiss chard, everything has to be put on a list. And then when I come home, when I empty the truck, everything that's left, I have to put it up against what went in there so that it shows what I sold. So they want to know seeds, land, and the amount of food you've had or gotten rid of or whatever, so that there's a paper trail. So why they want to do this, I don't know, because it's all supposed to be on an honor system. The organic community was always run on honor system, a trust.
Mm-hmm.
You trusted this person not to be dumping Miracle-Gro all over his garden when the organic inspector left. Well, if that's the way it is, then why don't you believe us when we say we're planting this food in this garden and we're bringing this food into the market and we sold it, instead of making us keep all this paperwork, which is a burden to a lot of people.
So in order to sell stuff, if you're doing conventional farming, is that true that you have to keep track of things as far as, like you said, what chemicals you put on your crops? Or
I don't see those guys having to keep track of anything. If they spray pesticides and they have to get a pesticide applicator's license, which they have to continually go to classes and get credits to keep up with that, which I can very much understand, including organic people. We use naturally grown and organically approved pesticides that are natural from nature. And we actually, in reality, need to do the same thing. We need to, if we want to be out spraying pesticides everywhere, we have to get a pesticide applicator's license, which I understand. But as far as a farmer and how much he's growing, conventionally, how much he's growing, how many pumpkins he's got, I don't think anybody in the conventional world is required to do anything. Not anywhere as remotely close to what an organic farmer has to do.
Can you explain what you just mentioned, pesticides, quote unquote, from nature? What do you mean by that?
In the organic community, we use things that keep bugs off our plants. But they can only be items that have been approved by Washington if you're going to be a certified grower. And they have an OMRI list that you can look up on the computer, Organic Materials Resource Index, that you can look through on the computer and find out what you can use. Now, just for instance, this is going to be a hypothetical. See the leaves on that maple tree? If you could pull the leaves off that maple tree and bring them in the house and put them in a blender and mix them up and then put them in a spray can with water and spray it on your tomatoes and keep bugs off your tomatoes, that would be an organic way of using something out of nature, like garlic. That keeps bugs off the plants. So those kind of things are approved for us to do.
It's the definition of a natural or organic pesticide that it would have to be some from the local environment, or could it be?
No, it could be something, as long as it's plant derivative.
Right.
We can use things for fertilizers in the ground that are mined out of the ground, you know, like vermiculite, you know, or peat. You know, we can use those things in our potting soil mixes. So they're naturally from the environment.
Yeah, as long as it's not made in the lab.
Yeah. I try to stay away from anything except what I have chickens, and I use the chicken manure. I put it in the woods for a year, and it reverts back to just a big pile of muck with a million earthworms in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just dig it up and spread it on my raised beds, and that's my fertilizer. We use cover crops, winter rye, buckwheats, oats. You know, these are crops that we put down on the ground periodically and grow where we usually grow food, but sometimes you want to give the ground a little rest, or over the winter, you know, you fall, you bring the field back to dirt again and you spread your winterized seed on it, and the grass grows and it holds the nutrients in the grass and in the roots of the grass, and then come spring, you disc all that back in again, and you've saved and protected those nutrients. They didn't get washed away from the winter rain and snow. So now you're all set to grow your crops again. So that's what we do with the cover crops. They suppress weeds and they build soil fertility. Whatever you take from the soil, you must put back into the soil. You're going to pull rows and rows of cucumbers and squash out of the ground and sell them. You better put something back in that soil by the next year, because you got to replenish what you've taken out. We use crop rotation, which is mandatory under the organic certification program, which means your tomatoes are over here 1 year, well, you better move them. And that's where the maps come in handy, where I agree with the map situation.
They require you to map everything.
Yeah, map everything and make sure you're moving things around. Bug infestation on certain crops will overwinter and come right back up that following year right there. And if you have the same crop year after year growing right there, well, guess what? You're just building up your insect world to really decimate your crop even worse the following year if you do it the same squat. So that's where crop rotation comes in, and these are all part of organic farming that people have been using for many years.
Have you ever read the book Botany of Desire?
No, I haven't.
Oh, great book.
You should. Good book about it?
Yeah, it's a book. The guy wrote, his name is Michael Pollan, ironically.
There's
a section about potatoes and tulips, apples, and marijuana. There's a whole history of the different crops and how they influenced culture and human behavior and history. But what you just said reminded me of the potatoes, because the whole idea of a homogeneous crop, you know, where you just grow one kind of thing, and then you have some sort of infestation, and such as what happened with the Irish potato.
That's a perfect example.
And so then you lose your entire crop. So it seems like organic farming deals with those issues by, as you said, moving things around a lot, quite often. And so it's required every year that you do that?
Yeah, you have to make your maps. And one of the things with the organic certification is they want you to, in January, when you're filling out your application, is to submit your crop maps, which farmers are always, you know, every minute things change.
Yeah.
Like you and I with this appointment. My whole day schedule completely changed at noontime today, and I was supposed to meet you at 1. What happens with plants are, you know, like this year, we had mud everywhere. Well, where are you going to put this? You can't put it there. It's muddy. You're going to have to throw something else there. So I'm a firm believer in, geez, could you at least wait until we plant the garden and then make a map and send it in, rather than send a map in January? And they're like, well, no, we want you to send your map in now, and if you want to make any changes, then you can make the changes to the map later. Which, is it 6 or 1 or a half a dozen of another or what?
Sounds like a lot of paperwork.
Yeah.
What's your favorite crop to grow? What do you think does really well here?
All my foods that I grow are my favorite ones. I mean, basils and garlics and tomatoes and you know, breathless cucumbers. Kohlrabi, I don't know if I mentioned that. What we find is when we go to these markets, in Manchester, for instance, there's a lot of ethnic people over there, Russians, Czechoslovakian, African, Asian, and they come and they say to you, can you grow this kind of food?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they'll mention something that they grew up eating, you know, back in the countries they came from. A ping pong eggplant, for example. Asian community approached me and asked me if I'd grow them, and I said, sure, and I got the seeds and I grew them, and it's an incredible eggplant. It's the most flavorful eggplant I've ever had, and I like to grow a lot of it every year. Sun gold cherry tomatoes. I've never put a tomato in my mouth that has as much tomato flavor as a sun gold cherry tomato. It's just incredible. It's a yellow tomato, but it's a hard time selling it because people think it hasn't turned red yet.
Mm-hmm.
It never turns red. It's yellow. It's called sun gold. And the flavor of that tomato is the best I've ever had in my life. It's incredible about food, how interesting food is, and learning from your customers. We can learn from them.
So you've learned a lot.
Yeah, farming is
different foods that you've grown.
A never-ending education from other farmers and from the public and what they want.
And it seems like you're pretty community-based. I lived in Oregon 5 years, and there's some big companies that produce organic agriculture, particularly in California. But I've heard the pros and cons on that, like whether you're better off buying, for instance, local strawberries that aren't necessarily organic, or buying organic strawberries from California and having them shipped, as far as the environmental consequences of that.
My firmly belief is first buy local.
Mm-hmm.
First support local economy. I don't go to California to buy my work clothes. I spend my money right here.
Right.
You know, and that's where I think the money should be spent. Local first, what sense is it to be, you know, purchasing food from Mexico and South America and things like that when you could be buying it right here? I've always said it's one of our biggest problems for local farmers and organic too, is we have to compete with the people who farm Logan Airport. And people look at me funny like, geez, I didn't know there was a farm on Logan Airport. Well, there isn't a farm on Logan Airport, but there's farmers at Logan Airport sitting in trucks, and they wait for the airplane to land that flew in from California and Mexico and Florida and Texas. And out of those bellies of those airplanes come food, and it goes into these trucks, and these trucks come up here to the local produce supplying people in the restaurants and things like that. And they do that 365 days a year. So the local farmers have to compete with those Logan Airport farmers. And because when you go into a restaurant or a store around here and you say, oh, I've got my lettuce ready here, it's June here, would you buy my lettuce? And they say, well, where are you going to be in November? Where are you going to be in January and February? You're not going to be here. But the guy driving that truck out there is going to be here for me.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be bringing stuff in from Logan Airport.
Yep.
So should I go with you now and then call him up in November and say, okay, I'm ready to start doing business with you again? So that's really difficult for us, you know.
Especially in New England, I would think.
Yeah, and the natural resources that you have to use to fly and ship this food in, you know.
Not to mention the low wages for a lot of these farm workers, even in California, the migrant farmers.
Fair trade.
Yeah.
You know, you're giving this guy a fair amount of money, you know. I mean, from what I understand, I don't drink coffee, but I understand that 1 pound of coffee, it takes one coffee bush to create 1 pound of coffee. You know, that's, I mean, look at how many people buy pounds of coffee. My God, how much coffee is being pumped out of one Dunkin' Donuts every day? You know, where's this coffee coming from, and how many people are working for pennies an hour to pick that coffee for those people?
And all the herbicides and pesticides sprayed on the crops. Coffee is something that I think is a huge issue that, because so many people drink it, it doesn't really get brought up.
Nobody wants to admit they might be supporting something that they don't believe in.
Yes.
You know, Common Ground Fair doesn't allow coffee sold on the premises.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Even organic, fair trade, shade grown.
No, they have a guy out in the parking lot, and he's a little coffee guy, and everybody goes out there to get their coffee.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think chocolate is in the same category.
Really?
Yeah.
Because there's just so many resources it takes to create such a...
Yeah, I think they probably look at it as being like a drug, too, you know,
caffeine. Addiction.
Stuff like that.
Could you just say one or two more things about just the big picture of where you see the organic agriculture move, and then if there's any final words you'd like to say?
I don't know. From my aspect, from what I do with my life, is basically educational. I'm not making a huge fortune here and buying land in the Bahamas and going and retiring. That'll be the day that you'll do that with organic farming. My whole position with what I feel from my own life is education, is working with the students. And high school kids and college kids come here, and they say they learn more in a day than a year in the classroom. And it's true. And so if I can convince one person to change their diet and eat organic food and realizing that this is a healthy way to live, then my job has been complete. So that's what I'm all about, educating the public about how to care for themselves and eat good food. So you got to take care of yourself. If you like living, then take care of yourself. A lot of my friends that I grew up in the 60s are all looking for liver transplants now and things like that because they didn't take care of themselves back when they were younger. So that's what it's all about with me, is educating the public about good soil care. The founding mission statement of the Organic Garden Club at UNH was healthy soils create healthy plants that create healthy food, that create healthy people and environment. And it's like a 4-H thing. So if you treat the soil right, plants will grow healthy. You can eat the healthy plants, it can make you healthy and make the environment healthy around you. We're using 5 to 6 billion pounds of pesticides a year on the agricultural land in the United States of America, which is an abomination.
Billion?
Billion, not million, but B with a B, B for billion. And that's a sad, sad legacy that they were leaving for the future generations of this country, that the land has been so inundated with chemicals. The frogs don't like it. The fish don't like it. You know, the birds don't like it. We ran into trouble with DDT and the bald eagle, and they didn't know about it until they realized that the DDT was getting in the mosquito was getting in the trout, and then the trout was getting into the bald eagle, and then he was sitting on the eggs and squishing them. And that's when they realized we got a problem, because the national symbol of this country was on the death's door. What is it going to take for us to realize this?
Everything's connected.
Yeah. I saw a lady on TV the other day holding her newborn baby, and she was furious up in Maine. She was very upset that her little baby, that she treasured more than herself, that this baby was born with hundreds of different chemicals in this baby, because on her couch was scotch guard or something that, you know, these chemicals that they put on furniture that was being inhaled and ingested by this woman while she was pregnant with this baby. And this baby's born with these chemicals. I mean, the kid doesn't even have a fighting chance to be 100%. He's born, and he's already on the losing end.
Yeah, they say the average person's blood and all the chemicals inside your body would be considered, you'd be considered a hazardous waste.
Yeah, yeah.
You wouldn't even pass the EPA standards.
Yeah,
and EPA is kind of low.
I probably have more parts per million of DDT in me than you do, because it's a cumulative thing. An older person will have 7 or 8 parts per million, and a younger person will have 3 or 4. So, my God, you know,
yeah.
I'm walking around with that much DDT in me.
All right. Well, Charlie, it's great to talk to you. I appreciate you taking the time, and we can let people know that they can find Charlie at Saturday Market in Portsmouth. And where is that located exactly?
In front of the town hall and the police station, up on the hill in front of the Portsmouth police station.
Okay.
From 8 to 1. Manchester, we do a farmer's market on Thursday afternoon in front of the Manchester City Library from 3 to 6:30. And then there's countless markets after that all over the state. If you want a farmer's market, you can find one.
Yeah, is there a site on the internet like Farmers Markets New Hampshire or something?
I think
like that.
The Department of Agriculture has something on there. If you got on their website or something like that, find everywhere. My God, 50 times already. That's amazing.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Charlie.
All right.
And this has been Jeff White with Down to Earth on Making Waves.
It's a mighty hard road, my poor hands are cold. My poor feet have traveled this hot, dusty road. Out of the dust bowl and westward we roam, through deserts so hot and through mountains so cold. To set at your table that white sparkling wine. Thank you.
That was Solas with Pastures of Plenty. And now for Jim Scott with Plant More Than You Harvest.
Plant more than you harvest, sun and water, earth and seas. Plant more than you harvest, give the earth all that it needs. Plant more than you harvest, give the earth all that it needs. The earth all that it needs. Clear the meadows and the highways, but plant stout trees between. Let the forests hold the hillsides, cover the earth with green. Let the forests hold the hillsides, cover the earth with green. Cover the earth with green. Plant the grains to feed every woman, man, and child. Some for all the beasts and birds, and some to just grow wild. Some for all the beasts and birds, and some to just grow wild. Some to just grow wild. Plant more than you harvest, sun and water, earth and sea. Plant more than you harvest, give the earth all that it needs. Plant more than you harvest, give the earth all that it needs. The earth all that it needs.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Meyerowitz, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is new and growing and hoping for your membership and participation. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be airing our Media Issues and More show, intended to be broadcast last Saturday, but which encountered technical problems. The show features an interview with Joshua Meyerowitz, UNH professor and media analyst, and highlights from the New Hampshire Peace Action Meeting, the True Majority Oreomobile, and Bert Cohen's talk on sustainability and peace. We leave you with this quote by Dom Helder Camara, Brazilian liberation theologian. When I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist.